Well, now we're going to return to our discussion of Carl Rogers. And as you can see, you know, that his theory, in many ways like existentialism, really talks about an attitude or an approach to life. And certainly the core idea that you're going to see running throughout this theory is the sense that individuals can grow and that each person is uniquely important. Now, Rogers' theory actually developed in 5 stages. And, you know, and what's nice to see in this is that Rogers himself, you know, was thinking and growing. And so if one looks at what happened, you'll see that there are various things that happened. And you'll see there were these 5 stages. First of all, there's this the precursor stage. And it occurred during the time that Carl Rogers was conducting therapy in Rochester, which is, he was in Rochester, New York, before he went to Ohio State. And through the experiences that he had as a therapist and his readings of therapists like Otto Rank, he began to develop the view of the person as self-directing. Thus, this was the initial phase of Rogers' intense focus on the person. His own doing therapy caused him to see you really ought to focus on the individual person and see where that person can go. Now, the next stage he called, and we call, the non-directive stage. And Rogers specifically pinpoints December the 11th, 1940, as the day in which the person-centered theory was born. On that day, he gave a talk at the University of Minnesota, and it was called Newer Concepts in Psychotherapy. And the reaction that he got to this paper made him realize that he was saying something new, and that actually this new thing he was saying came from him. So he was very pleased with this. And he began to write a book, which came out in 1942, a very famous book called Counseling and Psychotherapy. And this is the first time that you'll find people talking, or a therapist talking about reflection of feelings and non-directive techniques. And these become the trademarks of his writing. And so we're talking now, we're going all the way back to about early 1940s, and this theory is evolving. Now, the next stage you'll see is the client-centered stage. And so the name changes from non-directive counseling to client-centered counseling. And this was introduced by a book that he wrote called Client-Centered Therapy, which came out in 1951. And the major thesis in this move to client-centered therapy was that Rogers observed that people seeking help were not to be treated as dependent patients, which often was the focus, because if you're in an illness model, you know, you tend to think of people are ill in some way. They ail. They are patients. They are bringing you a problem for you to solve. And instead, he felt you have to relate to people with emotional difficulties as responsible clients. That is, they are the ones that are going to change their life. So he saw the therapeutic relationship as a joint venture between the therapist and the client, with the focus clearly being on helping the client to unfold the potential that he or she had. Now, the next stage then, which would be like the fourth stage in this sequence, is the experiential stage. And here, Rogers began to write that someone who was doing counseling or therapy should feel freer with their clients. So Rogers rejected the stereotype of the psychoanalyst who remained aloof from the patient, and suggested that the therapist, by being a warm, empathic human being, could model for the patient certain characteristics that would be most helpful in relating to others. Of course, like we were just talking about with Erickson, see, he saw psychotherapy as a highly interpersonal involvement with someone, And so he felt, you know, the therapist actually, by being warm and caring and listening, can actually present those skills to the client who might be able to understand them and use them. And he also believed the client had to experience the therapist as an authentic person before the client could examine his or her own authenticity. So he felt, and this of course is a tremendous contrast with Freud, who would have, you know, the therapist sitting behind the patient and would feel it doesn't really matter what the therapist is like, because the client is simply going to project all kinds of things onto the therapist. Rogers felt, you know, the therapist needs to be there as a very real human being, and helping the person to experience what it's like to relate to a very warm and caring person, and to somebody who does not reject the client no matter what happens. Now, we then get to the fifth stage, and this is the person-centered stage. And this is the stage now when Rogers will move from just talking about clients to kind of talking about society in general. And the current status of this theory is best portrayed by a change in emphasis from the client-centered therapy to person-centered approach. So the person-centered approach evolved because Rogers really became interested in dealing with more than just clients. And it's now believed, when Rogers died in 1987, that this theory that was originally developed to help in psychotherapy had wide application to life in general, had wide application in school systems, for example. And Rogers believed that it was effective, that is, his theory was effective as an educational technique. And also, it was helpful as a system for personal growth. You didn't necessarily have to have a problem in order to want to use his techniques. He felt that if you just want to become more alive, you want to become more adult, you want to become more mature, that his theory would help you to get there. And so he was a big believer in the T group movement, the encounter group movement, the growth group movement, etc., that began in the 1970s. By the way, I should ask, do you know what a T group is, an encounter group is? Have you been exposed? Now this is, okay. None of you know what an encounter group is. Okay, this is interesting. In the 1970s, if you'd been in university, you would have been in encounter groups, because they became so popular that many, many students engaged in these. And basically, some thought of them as a form of group therapy, but they really weren't. They were quite different. The idea was that you get a group of people together with a psychologist, and you try to help a group of students who want to work on whatever problem. Usually, the groups were heavily interpersonally focused. So you might have a group, say, of about 8 to 10 people. And you would meet maybe once a week. There were all different kinds of groups, but the most common ones, like, met once a week, sometimes twice a week, for maybe an hour and a half. And people usually brought up issues they were struggling with, often interpersonal issues. And you tried to create a very safe environment where students could talk about, you know, that they weren't developing the romantic relationships they wanted, or that they were sexually frightened of the involvements that they had, or they hadn't had any, but they were very frightened to have any. They were trying to break away from their parents, and their parents were having difficulty with it, they were having difficulty with it. They didn't want to offend their parents, but they also didn't want to stay at home. And there were many other developmental kind of issues at the time. And it was very interesting, the research that we did on these groups at the time. We found that actually they worked. But the premise of the group was that you had to be fairly healthy to come into the group. In other words, the emphasis was, this is not group therapy. If you need group therapy, you should be in a different group. But if you're a pretty healthy person, but you want to grow more, you want to have a chance in a safe environment to talk with others, especially people your own age who might be struggling with the same things, and to see, and also if you want some feedback about yourself, If you wanted people to tell you what they think you do well, what are the characteristics you have that people really like? And what are the characteristics that get in the way? Yes, Mr. Opuna?
I went to the workshops that we offer right now on campus, like overcoming anxiety and different ones, like meeting people on campus.
Yeah, okay, good question. The idea, it depends on the focus, and I'm not familiar with the groups on campus right now. If overcoming anxiety means overcoming an inordinate amount of anxiety that we might think of you would do in group therapy, then these would not be similar. However, if it's how do you relate better on campus? How do you become more effective in your interpersonal relationships? How do you get to know more people and develop interpersonal skills? Yes, that would be very much the kind of thing that this is. And it was very helpful to people because often you got feedback. And it was interesting, you know, someone would say things like, you know, I really want to be closer to people and I really try hard to meet people. But, you know, I guess I'm just ugly and unattractive and not interesting. And so nobody will relate to me. Well, you find often the feedback people gave often to such people was that's not really true. The reason why you have difficulty is, you know, you're not a very warm person. And that might stun someone that they didn't think about the fact that they're not very warm. They don't present themselves in such a way as to create for the other person the sense that they really would like to get involved. In fact, often people found out that they were perceived as very standoffish. So since they were very standoffish, nobody, you know, was really going to waste time getting to know them. And people would be incredibly surprised in these groups. Now, what we found out, and the premise then was that, you know, you need to be fairly healthy to be in such a group. And the research that myself and some friends did actually showed just that. That is, people did not improve symptoms in these groups. So if you came in depressed or anxious or compulsive, you probably stayed just about as depressed or anxious or compulsive as you had been. There weren't very significant differences in the group. But if you came in and you were saying that you wanted to find ways to be more intimate, you wanted to find ways to express yourself more spontaneously, you wanted to find ways to become more involved with other people, that those variables changed significantly for people, that people did learn to grow, did learn to improve their interpersonal lives, and it worked very well. What became key in these groups was the screening. You needed to screen out people who really had serious psychopathology and shouldn't be in this kind of a group. Often that would become an overwhelming experience for them. But for most college students, these groups worked very well. And they went on for a period of time, but they actually they lost their kind of steam once we got into the late 80s. And some attribute that, by the way, to the fact that we came into what a stage that a lot of people think of as a stage of narcissism, where people stopped being so interested in relating to people in groups. They were much more interested in themselves, and what can I get for me, and how can I get the things I want, and I don't have time to spend with a lot of other people who are after the same things. And so unfortunately, these groups have not continued a lot, although it seems like you're saying we do have some of them on campus, and you know, they're worth getting into. They really can be very helpful. And certainly, we know from experiments that have been done, even internationally, that sometimes, you know, bringing people together who are at war with each other, but who never talk to each other, can be a very effective mechanism for getting people to see that everybody is human. And this actually has been tried in a number of situations. And it's been shown to work. Of course, we've never been able to do it on a grand enough scale to get enough people together to learn that actually the people that they hate are as frightened as they are and want peace as much as they do and deplore the kind of deaths that occur. So the kind of things that Rogers wanted to work on later in his life were things like that. But of course, that's a goal far beyond what any one person is going to carry off. Now, It is important to appreciate that in Roger's theory, he never saw personality as static. He thought, and throughout the development of person-centered theory, the main concern always was on the dynamic aspects of the person. So on such things as communication, as relationships, and on the ability to change, which he profoundly believed in. So for Rogers, personality is a living, holistic entity, and it has goals and purposes and needs and meaning. And that's what you want to focus on. Now, this development then produced a number of basic tenets. He said that each person has an inherent tendency to actualize unique potential. And he even thought this is part of your genetic makeup, and that each person is unique in the sense that the biological and psychological potentials of any two people are never the same. So now, you know, most of us, I would hope, believe this. That is, the wonderfulness about this theory is that you are someone unlike anyone else who has ever lived. You have something to offer that no one else has to offer. And by the way, this theory now flies in the face of a lot of, you know, the current research on genomes and on, you know, trying to be able to biologically determine that there is some something inside you, biochemical or physiological, that we will be able to identify and therefore be able to, you know, change your behavior if you want your behavior changed. Now, I don't think any really thoughtful, mature person believes this will happen. I say that in the face of the fact that we got an awful lot of scientists, some of whom are psychologists, who really think eventually you will control all behavior and you'll be able to change all behavior by knowing enough about the biology of a person. Rogers, of course, would never have bought that. And the profoundness of the human personality would suggest we're probably not going to get to that, and obviously we wouldn't want to get to that. But there are those who think that's the route we should go. Now, the next tenet is that each person is born with an inherent bodily wisdom, which enables differentiation between experiences that actualize and those that do not actualize potential. He thought that there were certain experiences that actually started right at birth, and that people knew these experiences. He believed, for instance, that a baby knew immediately what feels good and what does not. And he felt that this is not on the basis of some rational reflection, because babies are not reflective, but rather there is some knowledge that develops organismically that allows a child immediately upon being born to have a sense that certain things are good and feel good and certain things are bad. Next, he said, it is crucially important to be fully open to all of our experiences. None of us are, by the way. You know, we might think of ourselves as being open people. We might think of ourselves as willing to try a lot of things. But this is a goal. This is a lifelong goal, to try to be open to new experiences. And it's a far more profound issue than one might think, because you don't want to be open to experiences that are dangerous. So that this doesn't mean, you know, you're willing to be someone who jumps out of a plane so you can have the experience of parachuting. After all, you know, some of those people land in a very unfortunate way. So it's not like you want to be open to everything, but you want to be open to every potential that may develop you as a human being. And life is a discovery of these things. Now next, he said, significant others are important to helping us to experience fully. And what he meant here is that, you know, there are key figures in your life. They may be parents, they may be loved ones, they may be teachers. And these people change throughout your life. Various people come into contact with you. And they help you to experience more fully. And there are some people that you meet that you become very dear friends with at various times in your life. And almost always those people open up certain aspects of your personality. That is, they touch you in a way that you begin to think differently. You begin to feel differently. You begin to feel better. Or there may be people that you don't necessarily have as friends, in the sense of someone very close, but they really create, just seeing them and seeing what they do, creates a sense of hope. When I was younger, one person who came across very charismatically was when President John Kennedy became a candidate to be president. I mean, somehow when Kennedy became president, people began to believe the world can be a better place. People began to have the fantasy that life can be warm and even the government of all places can be responsive to you. And of course, Kennedy did things which we'll mention, like started the Community Mental Health Centers Act, which of course took all those people who prior to this were being lodged in state mental hospitals, which by the way were always way out in the sticks and never near where anybody would see them. And he brought community mental health treatment right into the community, and he made people aware of the fact that we can do something for these people. Well, he did many other things like that, and some presidents have had that effect of making people believers. Now, also, he said that experiencing becomes more than bodily sensing as the child grows older. And what he said is that, the very small infant is kind of growing depending on what do they experience within themselves. That is physically what happens to them. But as they develop cognition, they develop this broader appreciation that life is very complex. And there are many experiences both to be appreciated and to be integrated. That there are some things you see and you want to make that a part of you. Then he said that through complex interactions with one's own body and with other persons, each individual develops a concept of the self. And self-concept is very key in Rogers' theory. The complex configuration of the self-concept begins when an individual experiences his or own physical self as separate from the environment. So we're talking very early in life when the child begins to realize there is an environment and there is me and they're not the same. Now, this is when children are the beginnings of this are when children begin to experience like their anatomical needs and their social needs differ. It's almost like when the child discovers there's a difference between when I put my thumb in my mouth and when I put my toy in my mouth. That on one time, I'm getting this gratification in one way, and then later I'm getting it another way. And then as children grow older, they slowly build up increasingly differentiated fields of experience. And what we call these are self-experiences. And they become further elaborated through interactions with significant others until finally we form a self-concept. So we start off and everything we experience is kind of focused on ourselves. Then we begin to realize there's a real world. Then we begin to interact with a real world. Then we begin to learn some of those things are good and some of those things are not. And we begin to incorporate some of those things that we think are good into ourselves so that we want them to be part of our definition of me. And then eventually, that's your self-concept. I also should mention here that this is also a time once you develop a self-concept, then you're also developing a need to receive positive regard from others. I mean, not only do you need to have a self-concept about who am I, but once I decide in a way, who am I need to have verification of that by having other people like the self that I am. Now, this next tenet is very important, and it follows from just what I said. One can sacrifice the wisdom of one's own experience to gain the love of another person. This is a very tricky issue, because if you give up the wisdom of your own experiences, that is, if you're going in a certain direction, or you want to be a certain kind of person, or you believe in a certain set of values, but you are not feeling you're being loved for this, you may decide to behave in a way, to present yourself in a way, as a person that you think other people will love. And what Rogers noted was that, you know, you can either be loved unconditionally, or you could be loved conditionally. Now, it's wonderful to be unconditionally loved. And of course, such an experience can greatly free a person. We tend to see unconditional love sometimes, you know, if we have an infant. I mean, if you hold an infant, in your arms, let's say that's a few months old, I mean, you automatically feel very protective. You can feel very warm towards the child. You don't feel you're asking anything from the child, although sometimes you may wish the child would not cry, but that may be about the only thing. But you really just want to give to the child. You want the child to feel warm. You want the child to feel cared for, etc. That kind of unconditional love is wonderful. It is not what usually happens in life. Conditional love really is far more common, and less consistently more consistently, it is the rule in life that the love you experience from others has some conditions on it. Now, if we have an intense need to be loved, and we accept myriad conditions from someone else in order to get their love, then we begin to lose ourselves. We don't know that, of course, because we don't realize how much we're giving up in order to get the love of that other person. And what does occur, though, in this is that you actually end up so losing sight of your own unique self, that because you want this other person to love you, that you give in to so many demands from the other person, so many conditions, that you be a way you don't necessarily want to be, that you lose yourself. And so Rogers believed that if you were not on the path to self-actualization, that is, you weren't experiencing at least some unconditional self-regard, then there might be a need for therapeutic experiences. And this really flows so well, because if you lose your own uniqueness, if you lose the sense of yourself, eventually you're going to become a very confused person. And by the way, one of the things that just happens is if you ever get trapped into this situation, and you get trapped because there's someone out there who seems very glamorous, very desirable, highly excites you, and so you want this person to love you. And so you begin finding out, like, what would this person want from me? And you listen very carefully, and so this person wants you to be a certain way, so you become that way, and then they want something else, and so you become that, and they want something else, and you become that. Pretty soon, you're working very hard to be all of these things to someone, and you have stopped thinking about, who am I? Who would I like to be? And of course, the other person, and this is always the tragedy, isn't really interested in you, because you're not showing them who you really are. So if the relationship goes on for a while, let's say, and it leads into marriage, you just know at some point it's going to become very painful, because you will finally give up trying to be all these things that somebody else wants. You'll realize you've lost yourself, and you will need help in beginning to find yourself again. And you'll also experience, probably a very profound sense of sadness that you've put all this energy into something only to realize you will never really be loved, especially by this other person. And in fact, you have never really exposed the true you to this person. Now, Roger said, he saw a lot of these people come into therapy. And when they come into therapy, there are certain things that he had observed don't work. One of them is, if you look at how do people try to help other people? Well, He said there were four major techniques that he thought are really useless. One is like ordering a person or forbidding a person to do certain things. As if you say to somebody who has a problem, like they're overly hostile, stop being hostile. As if the person could do that, they wouldn't do it. So he felt, this doesn't get you anywhere. Then he felt exhortation is another useless activity. In the sense, you know, of keep championing people to be something. Whatever it is they want to be, you keep telling them, you can be it if you want to. That exhortation is much too simplistic. And he thought suggestion isn't going to get you anywhere either. And suggestion, you know, included reassurance and encouragement and things like that. You know, you should try this out. I think you can do it, et cetera, et cetera. He felt that there are the conflicts inside a person, and perhaps the defenses inside a person, are far too complex, far too profound, that you can simply make suggestions to someone and they'll change. And so he said, you know, straight advice is useless. And so he wouldn't have put a lot into writing to Ann Landers or Dear Abby or people like that and getting back a bit of advice about what might work for you to solve this problem. Because he said, you know, people don't change that simply. So once he then had identified that none of these techniques have really been successful, he felt they should all be abandoned. None of these things are really going to change people. And so he replaced these techniques, and he posited that people have the capacity to change within themselves. And he began to talk about conditions for growth and psychotherapy. And he came up with a number of conditions. And his view was that people have the capacity to change within themselves, and they will change in constructive ways if the therapist creates the right conditions for growth. And the first condition was that the client and the therapist are in psychological contact. That is, each makes an impact on the phenomenological field of the other. Very different than what we talked about in psychoanalysis. Here, Rogers is saying the therapist really does have to enter the world of the patient, and the patient has to experience that the psychologist has entered that world, that the psychologist really does feel and understand what it is the client is going through. Next, the client needs to be in a state of incongruence, and they have to feel anxious about it. Now, both of those are key. The client, first of all, has to experience there is something about the way I am and the way I wish to be that are not the same. In other words, I am not whom I wish to be. And the person has to be anxious about it, because if they're not anxious about it, they probably won't change. So Rogers felt there has to be this unpleasant experience that this discrepancy between who I actually want to be and who I think I am makes me so uncomfortable, I'm willing to work at it in therapy. Then he said the therapist is congruent, that is, in harmony in the relationship. And what that means is that the therapist is able to agree with the client. So as the therapist listens to the client talk about what he or she wishes to pursue in therapy, and this may not happen, by the way, in the first few sessions, but at some point, it becomes clear to the therapist what the client wants, and the therapist is able to let the client know they understand that, so they're both seeking the same goal. Then he said the therapist really has to experience unconditional positive regard for the client. This is a lovely sounding statement, very, very profound and very difficult. And this cannot happen in every first session in therapy. There are people who are really unlikable. And in fact, people end up in therapy at times for that reason, that everybody finds them unlikable. What Rogers, you know, was saying is when you see that unlikableness, you have to be willing to suspend your dislike for the person. You have to be willing to try to find some way to feel there is a goodness in this individual that I can relate to, so that I can accept this person unappealing as he or she is. Also, the therapist needs to experience an empathic understanding of the client's internal frame of reference. That is, not everybody is depressed for the same reasons, or anxious for the same reasons, or angry for the same reasons, or disappointed for the same reasons, and not everybody aspires to the same kinds of things. And so the therapist has to have a real ability to listen and to become empathic and accepting of what it is a client wishes. Now, I can tell you, I have found that there are some people who do counseling who are in religions who have a lot of difficulty with this, because they're so rule-bound that when the person comes in and says that they have sexual practices that religion wouldn't like, or the person is divorced and the religion doesn't allow divorce, or whatever, that therapists sometimes find they have a lot of difficulty in accepting those behaviors. And what Rogers would say is, you'll never be effective as a therapist with this person if you start off rejecting what they do. You have to learn to be empathic and to appreciate whatever the person is doing, that there is some motive inside the person, and that for those behaviors that are really bad, the person does want to change. Then he said the client needs to perceive the therapist's unconditional positive regard and the therapist's empathic understanding. That is, it's not sufficient enough for you as the therapist to really care about this person and to have unconditional positive regard, but the client's got to be able to experience that. And what I would say is, the more disturbed the client is, often the more difficulty the client has in experiencing that, even from the most skilled therapist. And the very skilled therapist has to be very careful with this. When you talk about having unconditional positive regard and being empathic, if you have a fairly primitively functioning patient and you are too warm or too caring, you'll scare the person away. Because often that's their problem, is that they have a lot of difficulty with people getting close to them. So you have to know as a therapist like how much you can kind of convey to someone that you understand them, that you appreciate them, and yet not create a sense of being seductive, or not create a sense that you would want a closer relationship with them, because that may just scare them away. Also, for some people, if you create too early, if you communicate too early, you really understand what the other person is going through, they become offended. They feel, I'm a very complex person. I've only been talking to you for a couple of sessions. How can you possibly know what I'm going through? So this is not an automatic kind of thing. This is a very intricate process where if you're going to be a very skilled therapist, it takes time for you to make contact with the client, to make safe contact with the client, and to communicate to the client precisely that you're with that person, that you care about that person, that you're accepting of whatever it is they're talking about, and you don't overwhelm them. Now, Rogers then posited that if these six conditions exist, then there are 10 changes that you can observe in clients. He said, once the client actually believes that they're safe with you, that there really is a sense of unconditional positive regard, the clients will increasingly express their feelings about their lives and problems. That is, they will open up more. They will tell you more. You will become more aware of what has brought them there. And most of the time, the vast majority of the time, people do not tell you their most profound conflicts in the first or second session. People have to get comfortable before they begin to talk about some of the things that are really troubling to them. And the exception sometimes, to some degree, are people who are profoundly disturbed, who come in and they tell you all kinds of primitive things in the first session because they absolutely have no control over their emotional life. But for most people, they have to work towards it. So you see an increasing openness as people feel safe and feel you're really listening. Also, and this is key, if you remember, I was saying to you that you know, when Rogers developed this client-centered model, the idea was that the focus is to be on the client. And the client here increasingly becomes accurate in their assessment of the meaning of their feelings. Now, just take you back a second. When Rogers first started out, and he came up with this non-directive theory of counseling, part of what non-directive meant is you don't step in and tell the client what to do. That is, the client, you know, says, I'm anxious, you don't say, avoid anxiety-producing situations. What happens is you try to get the client to really listen to their anxiety. You try to get the client to talk about all the dimensions of this anxiety. You try to get the client to start talking about, well, are there alternatives that perhaps you might want to consider? Are there ways in which you can be a participant in changing your life? When he moved to client-centered, those techniques came along. He just wanted to emphasize the idea that the therapy has to be on a unique person. And so each unique person has to find their way to solve their problems. And this is a very complex process. And some of the wording at times makes it look like it's easy to do this. And as a result, Rogers' theory got a lot of acceptance because people thought, well, I can do that. Actually, that's a mistake. If you're going to do this is a very complex procedure to learn if you're going to do it well. Now, and then he said, clients will begin to discuss the incongruity between their self-concepts and their experiences. In other words, as someone becomes more sensitive to what their own difficulties are, they then begin to take on this awareness that, you know, I am not like the person I wish to be. And they can talk about that. And it's absolutely necessary that someone discover there is that discrepancy in them if they're going to change in therapy. Then, and what Rogers posited would be the next step then, is people feel threatened by the incongruity. I mean, this is what gets you in therapy. I would really like to be this way, but I'm this way. And I want to change that gap between what I perceive as being the ideal I want to achieve and what I think I'm really like now. Then he said that clients will then begin to experience fully, that is consciously, feelings that have in the past been denied either to awareness or else they've been distorted in awareness. And that's where you get, you know, people disclosing things like they felt that they've been very warm and caring and they've tried very hard and yet they get rejected. They fail all the time in interpersonal relationships. They don't understand it because they feel that they're so warm and giving. Now, what's interesting is you often find that that's a real deception. That is actually, if you look carefully at the person, they're cold. They're not giving. They're put offish. And so part of the therapist's job is to help them to reflect on what do you do when you meet people? How do you present to yourself? What do you think is going to happen with that other person? Why are you attracted to the other person? And there's nothing you know, more telling than when you find somebody describing someone that they really would be interested in, and when you really get them to tell you about the other person's pretty cold and distant. And you've already noticed by the way that the client relates to you that the client is cold and distant. And so you're thinking, well, on one hand, this person is saying, I really want to have a close relationship. On the other hand, they've set up about every circumstance imaginable that it can't happen. Because if you yourself are going to come across as fairly cold, and then you're going to approach people who are fairly cold, probably nothing is going to occur. And this is where you take people then on the path of discovery. And Rogers said, clients will then become capable of reorganizing their self-concepts by assimilating previously threatening experiences. That is, you begin to help them to realize, you know, you're really very frightened of meeting with people. And you get them to talk about that. And the person begins to express the fact, yes, I am very frightened. And then you try to help them to assess more realistically who is it they approach. Because if they're not approaching people who really are desirable for them, and that means they're not approaching people where there would be some risk for them, then they're not going to be able to make the changes that they say they want to make. Then Rogers says, as therapy continues, clients' self-concepts will become increasingly congruent with their experiences. Now, this means if therapy is working. That is, clients begin to recognize that the experiences that they are having are the experiences they want to have. Now, this also, by the way, may have the intricacy of the self-concept may have changed. That is, someone may have realized that I have to make some changes in the way I want to be in order for me to be successful with other people. And in fact, almost always, that's part of this process. And as this is going on, the client increasingly is capable of experiencing the therapist's really unconditional positive regard for them. The client is able to acknowledge to you, I realize that no matter how I've presented myself, and when I've told you some things that I think are horrible, and I've talked about my worst depressions or my most intense anxieties, I realize that, you know, you don't get upset with me. This is a tremendously important time in therapy because the client is now able to tell the therapist something that actually can be taken outside the session. And that is that you can begin to realize other people really can love me. I don't have to be perfect. I don't have to try to be on all the time. That I can really be myself and another person could care for me. And so the next step is the client then becomes more aware of themselves. They become more positive about themselves. They like themselves now, and they're much more relaxed than they were. And then the tenth one is that clients will come to evaluate their own experiences more in terms of their organismic valuing process and less in terms of the values endorsed by other people. In another language, what that really means is that people will listen to themselves and listen to their experiences, listen to what it is they want to be, and not have to look outside and see what is it that society demands I be, and then I will be that. Then what Rogers thought was that that this whole entire process we're describing will lead a person to be existentially what they really are rather than what other people would wish them to be. And, you know, this is a long process. I've taken you through it, you know, very quickly. But it's a very different kind of therapy than the kind of therapy we talked about previously. And we are going to talk about a little more about Rogers, and then we're going to go into other theories. And this evolution we're talking about really is the evolution of clinical psychology. But for today, we can stop, and we'll start again tomorrow.